The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. Well, today we're going to start off with part two of my conversation with Sanho Tree. Sanho is the director of the Drug Policy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. There was a there was actually a hearing the Irish Parliament, the Oireachtas, held on, or a committee of the Oireachtas, rather, held on the situation in Colombia, the peace process there. A couple of trade union representatives, high officials, came in to talk, and among the one of the messages that stood out most is that Colombia is the most dangerous place in the world right now to be a union organizer.
Yeah, yeah, and it's another common thread. To be an environmental defender these days, to protect the environment, it used to be the Brazil was the most dangerous place, right? And it still is incredibly dangerous. President Bolsonaro, this fascist, basically is declaring war against the indigenous peoples and is vowing to open up the Amazon and basically will bulldoze it. He only sees, you know, commercial development as being the only reasonable thing to do with the Amazon. And of course, those are the lungs of the earth, incredibly sensitive and vital environmental areas are going to be deforested now. But just this year, just this month, the Philippines actually surpassed Brazil as being the most dangerous place to be an environmental defender. So large agribusinesses are taking over land, and so people who are protesting are the ones being targeted now. So it's no coincidence you got these are all right-wing governments, and you've got a lot of social defenders being targeted. And so they need our help and our solidarity right now.
God. And of course, people can find out more by following you. And there's also the Washington Office on Latin America and the Latin America Working Group. There are a few good organizations, some trade union groups that are also where I think Human Rights Watch has some good things happening. I mean, the NGOs are active. That's the good part.
Yeah.
The NGOs are the targets now.
Mm-hmm. The NGOs are active. The government isn't very active, so we don't really have a foreign policy in the State Department. We have Trump's tantrums, and you know, a lot of people just hunkering down, trying not to get noticed or do anything, really. It's just madness in Washington these days. You used to have these formal mechanisms of policy formation, and you had interagency coordination, and you'd work out the bugs, and you'd cross your T's and dot your I's, and look at all the different interactions and how it's going to ripple, ripple effects. None of that these days. It's whatever the president wants, and he can overturn, policy that took years to develop and turn it over in an afternoon with a tweet. It's extremely demoralizing for people in government who are actually trying to do good things. They're just basically trying to survive at this point. The pettiness with which this White House will reach down into the bureaucracy and punish people it views as disloyal personally to the president is frightening. In fact, the JAG, the Judge Advocate General, the military prosecutors who prosecuted the Navy SEAL for war crimes in Afghanistan a few months ago, Trump has ordered that they not get their commendations. So they're being punished for actually prosecuting a Navy SEAL who committed war crimes. I mean, just think about that. They did their jobs, and for that, Trump is punishing them.
Well, that's a good segue to get back to the United States. We've seen how bad things can get in the Philippines, and we're watching the civil war that's supposed to be ending. Not ending. So let's get back to the U.S. Now, of course, we've had a kinder, gentler drug war these past few years. The opioid overdose crisis has resulted in more people understanding that getting naloxone into the hands of not just first responders, but also friends and family and of people who use opioids themselves is a smart thing to do. And that's been happening. We've had, you know, people pushing the idea, people fighting hard for the idea of supervised injection facilities and safe consumption facilities around the country, and more talking openly about the need for those. So that's a good thing. Yeah, it is.
It is.
And we had a drug czar candidate, the first one, Tom Marino, the former representative from Pennsylvania, whose bright idea was to convert prisons and jails into inpatient treatment facilities. The guards just wouldn't have badges. And that's pretty much the only change. And, you know, as bad as that was, you at least knew that there was still a kinder, gentler, that the Democrats and the liberals would at least, and they're, you know, I was talking to you before this, one of the candidates, Andrew Yang, I was looking through his drug policy platform, and one thing that stood out was mandatory 3-day stays in a facility for all overdose victims so that they can be convinced to go into treatment.
Yeah,
because the one thing that's certainly going to get you to go in for hospital for medical care when you've had an overdose is the notion that you're going to be locked away but it won't be called a jail. They'll convert it.
Right.
Yeah, they won't have badges. That's how you can tell. This is just, and you know, I mean, and there is that, but you know, we seem to have changed because we have an effective treatment for opioid use disorder, because we have the protocols and know how to use methadone. We know how to use buprenorphine, and they're actually pretty successful. And we're talking more and more about the need for heroin assisted treatment, because we need to go there. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, and which is so different than the meth fear the meth hysteria from a few years back, a decade or so back, or the crack hysteria from the 80s. I mean, it's so much different, but they're also different drugs. We don't have, they're stimulants, and we don't have a substitution treatment. We don't have the maintenance treatment, because even though there's research showing that it works, dextroamphetamine, John Grabowski down in Texas, brilliant guy. Anyway, even though there is some research showing it works, for some reason, we won't do it. And of course, now we're seeing more meth in the state of Oregon and in various other places. We're seeing a return of meth. We're hearing about more cocaine out there. And it's like I'm going to say it until it actually happens, which unfortunately won't be too much longer. There are chemists out there working on what are called synthetic cathinones, mm-hmm. and those are stimulants, and they are going to make some that have the rush of methamphetamine with the sort of smooth appeal of the cocaine. It'll be a designer drug. It'll be scary, powerful, and people will die.
And the unintended side effects and consequences. We don't know about these things.
Yeah. So what do you think about the future of America, my friend?
Well, this is precisely why I'm glad they haven't debated drug policy in the presidential debates yet. When you have 24 candidates and each one gets 60 seconds or whatever, you know, it's very difficult to talk about complex policy proposals. Later on, when you narrow down the number of candidates and you might get, you know, 3 or 4 minutes, then maybe you can have a slightly more substantive discussion. But you really get the amount of time necessary to really flesh out these alternatives, right? For instance, they can talk about methadone and buprenorphine, but they're not going to talk about safe supply movement. Hashtag safe supply. Check it out. You know what they're doing in British Columbia, for instance, where doctors can prescribe hydromorphone or Dilaudid to people with opioid use disorders, so that they're not forced to go out into the street and play fentanyl roulette. That's like a no-brainer to me, right? We know how to prevent people from dying from unintentional fentanyl overdose, and we're not doing it. It sends the wrong moral message, I guess, to keep people alive. I mean, that's the implication, right? That if you're a politician who doesn't support it, that at some level, and you know it's going to lead to more deaths, then you've got to think that, you know, the wages of sin ought to be death, and that will somehow send the right message, which has been the old standby, rationale for a lot of this stuff. But if it's your child or someone that you love who overdoses at a festival or something because you didn't have, you know, pill checking, drug testing, If you oppose these kinds of basic harm reduction measures, then I think as a politician, you're basically supporting a randomized death penalty, that someone else's loved one should pay the price, and that somehow that's going to send a message to the rest of the world to not do this. It doesn't work. It hasn't worked. And they're just killing people for no good reason.
Throw us a ray of sunshine. Jesus, this is depressing.
Well, actually, I'm an optimist, right? As a former historian, right, my heroes are the people who worked in the civil rights movement in the 40s and 50s, you know, less so the 60s. My heroes were the suffragettes working, you know, a century ago, you know, in the turn of the 1900. Back when people thought the odds were so stacked against you that you'll never see these kinds of changes in your lifetime, and yet within a generation, within a dozen years, people have seen tremendous change. It is possible, so we mustn't lose sight of that. Hell, we went through alcohol prohibition and then repeal, right? All within one generation. So yeah, in hindsight, the only thing that's inevitable is change itself, and sometimes it's even for the better.
You're right. There's a great man once said, "Perspective, use it or lose it." Right.
Yeah.
Well, sir, again, we're speaking with Sanho Tree. He is the director of the Drug Policy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. He's a military historian and a writer and a researcher and a brilliant, brilliant person who is, so involved in so many things. You must check out we must make sure that people know where to follow you on social media, so give them that stuff.
My Twitter handle is just @SanhoTree. Or you go to my website at www.ips-dc.org.
And there you go. And actually, there's a lot of stuff at the IPS website. They go well beyond drug policy. But bless them, they've been talking about drug policy for a very long time. And liberals thought that this was an issue they wouldn't touch, but they knew there were some conservatives who would talk about marijuana and maybe some other stuff, that, you know, Buckley was out there doing his thing. And the conservatives thought this was an issue they didn't want to touch. And but, you know, they knew there were some liberals out there who were talking this kind of stuff. Yeah. But it was hard to find a real, you know, I don't know, maybe it's because it seems so counterintuitive. The conservative support is something that people know about more. And with, the, you know, we just think of Democrats as being scared and spineless and running away. And the fact that IPS, which is very, very proudly progressive, more on the left, would it be fair to call it a left?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. You know, it's very proudly on you know, left is still right and right is still wrong. You know, the fact that an institution like IPS has been involved in that for so many years, I think, is terrific. I wish more people realize that. Like I say, credit
Thank
where
you.
It's
we've,
due. Credit where it's due.
We've been around 54 years now. It's been quite a ride. Well, if you haven't been involved in politics yet, this is the time to do it. if you're angry that they have impeached Trump and you haven't, and your local member of Congress has not supported impeachment yet, ask yourself: have you contacted them? Have you called them? Have you written them? They're not mind readers, and if you haven't contacted them, then perhaps you're part of the problem as well. So you know, there are a lot of us thinking similar things out there in the world, and. But we're all atomized unless we start acting together. And only then can we actually produce some change.
And with that, Sanho, thank you so much for all your time. And thank you so much. And for all that for your time and for all the stuff that you do. God bless.
My pleasure.
You. That was my conversation with Sanho Trees, director of the Drug Policy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. They're a think tank based in Washington, D.C.
America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse. In order to fight and defeat this enemy, it is necessary to wage a new all-out offensive. I have asked the Congress to provide the legislative authority and the funds to fuel this kind of an offensive.
You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org. Now, at the top of that interview, I mentioned a discussion that had been held at the Oireachtas at the Irish Parliament on the Colombian peace process. It was a joint committee on foreign affairs and trade and defense. We're going to hear now from the conclusion of that discussion. We're going to hear Senator Paul Gavin. He's a Labour Party member of the Irish Senate, the Seanad Éireann. And then we'll hear from Mariella Cohen. She is Senior International Officer with the Trades Union Congress.
Thanks indeed, and thanks for allowing me. I'm a guest here this morning as well. I want to pay tribute to Justice for Colombia. I was fortunate enough to be part of the most recent delegation. And I want to pay particular tribute to the Force of Trade Union because it's so significant, I think, the support that your union is giving to this incredible civil society organisation. And they really are punching at a very high level, because one of the most significant things from our visit was the fact that the Colombian government felt the need to meet with us at the end of the week. And I thought that was very significant, and in its own way, you know, very positive. I want to share just very briefly, if I may, Chair, a couple of the quotes, because we did meet a whole range of people from trade unions, social leaders, community leaders. It's a very moving week, actually, because it is such a beautiful country. But the level of oppression there is quite shocking, frankly. One of the human rights defenders said to me directly, "We're witnessing a genocide of social trade union leaders and human rights defenders." I mean, that's a shocking statement to hear. Perhaps the saddest statement was from Ada Avella, who was a member of parliament for the Patriotic Union Party. She's, like myself, a lifelong trade unionist. She said, "There aren't so many trade unionists killed lately, but then there aren't so many of us left." What an absolutely shocking statement to make. I was disturbed by what Mariella told us in terms of the new restrictions on visiting the transition zones, because we visited Tierra Grata in the northeast of Colombia in the La Paz district. We could see firsthand that the potential is here to deliver something significant economically in terms of independence. But it just isn't happening for lack of support. And it was disturbing that when we raised it with the government in that meeting at the end of the week, effectively we were met with denial. And I found that disappointing. And the other thing is, I'm supposed to speak as an Irish Republican, I didn't hear the language of a peace process from the government ministers. And I found that particularly disturbing. We were first-hand witnesses, and yet we were told that we were effectively, I think the word lies was used a number of times. And I just didn't hear that language that we want to, that we would expect from a peace process, and indeed what we would hear from our own peace process, despite the challenges from time to time. Perhaps the most moving part of the mission, though, was to visit Cajibio, a town in North Corca, because what we saw there in a community setting was pictures on the wall of local community leaders who've been murdered in the last couple of years, young men, many of them members of the Fensuagro Agricultural Trade Union. And I have to say, I won't name the Irish company, but this community setting was surrounded by property owned by an Irish company, and they said to us that the paramilitaries were using the land to come out in the dark to attack and kill their people. And as an Irishman, I found that particularly disturbing. We had a very positive meeting with Alison Milton, and one of the things she did commit to do was to go and visit that mine. And if I may be so bold as to suggest that a further action for this committee might be just to write to the ambassador to ask her about that visit. Has it taken place, and what are her views on it? Because as my colleague Sean said, and by the way, Sean sends his apologies, he had to go to Parliament. I mean, really, you know, we as a country should not be importing blood coal. And I did note that in a recent response, the Tarnishta did indicate he'd have a further look at this. And I really hope he does, because it's very much not in keeping with a lot of the very good work, in fairness, that's being done by Ireland. I want to just finish by asking a couple of questions. The first is, you mentioned the local elections in October, and that was a big topic when we were over there. How can these elections be free and fair, or how free and fair are they likely to be, given that we met people, and you've mentioned it yourself, telling us that they're being threatened, their lives are being threatened. Very hard to run an election when people's lives are being threatened. And again, as a number of people have said, it's just struck me that there's a vacuum where the defence of leaders should be. There's a gaping vacuum. And again, I have to say, particularly the representatives of the Justice Department and the police, there just seemed to be a denial. And yet the facts are there, the facts are in terms of that. And that leads on to the second question. And it's a difficult question, and perhaps I'm asking for an opinion. But in terms of the FARC members being killed by right-wing paramilitaries, these paramilitaries are acting with impunity. That's very clear. The question I want to ask is, are they also acting in collusion with the state? I think that's it, Chair. I just want to thank Justice for Columbia for giving me the opportunity to go out there. I really do hope that our Irish government really does speak with a strong, loud voice, and I would acknowledge the work of Eamon Gilmore as well, by the way, in relation to this issue, because I have to say, just on a personal human level, I found it deeply shocking to meet people whose relatives are killed. And this is not something the number of deaths are increasing. The number of deaths have been increasing since the peace process was signed. Very hard to keep a peace process going when one side are being slaughtered. Thank you.
Sure. Right, Mariella.
So, on the delegations, I would just add to the tribute paid to Falstaff for supporting the Peace Monitor delegations. One feature of the delegations is that they're meeting everyone, you know, and I would recognise the government for having engaged with those delegations, the embassy in London and you know, the ministers meeting at the highest level. That's been incredibly valued, that there's been that engagement, and I think it gives credibility to the delegation that they're meeting with everyone, the HEP, the UN, the institutions, the parties. In terms of the environment, I think there's, you know, concerns around the extractive industries and the impact that's having on the environment. You heard about the mine, and that licences be given respecting the indigenous land and Afro-Colombian land that's constitutionally provided for, the respect for those lands. There's campaigns around fracking as well, and obviously the concern around the possible fumigation of crops with glyphosate, which is incredibly toxic. Yeah, so there are concerns around the environment. On the elections, I think obviously having international observers would be incredibly important, but one of the concerns sometimes is the observers come, you know, just a day before, and the problem in Colombia isn't just about the day of the election, it's about what happens before the election, you know. It's about the violence, intimidation that comes in the build-up to an election. And as I said, the MOE, you know, and I can send through their report, the electoral observer mission, they released a report in May, at the end of May, saying that since last October, five mayoral candidates and two aspiring council members were amongst the 75 registered political assassinations, and that 37 political activists had survived assassination attempts. So I think, you know, the elections come in a context of what's happened before, and I think there needs to be attention put on that issue, and maybe some monitoring, you know, at this stage. Obviously for the FARC, it's the first time they'll be participating in local elections, and they'll be quite exposed, so that's going to be very difficult. I'm not sure, I think the EU, you know, has sent observations before in elections previously, so it would be important to see what kind of monitoring can take place. And obviously the UN mission has a mandate for the political to verify the political reincorporation of the FARC, so they will be monitoring the situation as well. In terms of the collusion, I would say all the different killings of the members of the FARC obviously vary. In some cases it has been directly the army, like the case of Dimar Torres that I mentioned. Other cases, it's been ELN, paramilitary groups, maybe linked to dissidents as well. So it's a very complex, and it does depend on the region as well. And some of them would be clearly, you know, politically motivated. Others would be not sure, you know, what the reasons would be. I think the importance is about, obviously, where there has been the state involvement for those to be brought to justice. I think the whole issue of paramilitaries, you know, in the peace agreement, there's a special investigative unit that's supposed to be set up to dismantle and investigate the paramilitaries. There was a huge back and forth with the former Attorney General over this unit, because the whole point of the unit was to be completely autonomous, and it had to then be created under the Attorney General's office because his opposition to it, and it would be important to support that unit to have its autonomy to actually investigate and dismantle the paramilitary groups, and also to look at the political... There was supposed to be kind of a pact, a political pact across the country in terms of taking violence out of politics, in terms of changing the hate. And the HEP has a role there in terms of the reconciliation as well. So it all, you know, one key feature of the peace agreement is that it's comprehensive and it's interlinked. And if you start chipping away and taking bits, other bits don't work, you know. So you have to implement it as a whole. If FARC members don't have legal guarantees, then... why would they offer the truth? You know, so there's all these kind of questions that need to be... the government needs to see the agreement as a whole. And in what, just to reiterate what Kevin said in terms of hosting both parties, we think, you know, any opportunity for signatories to the agreement to be recognised as such and to give their views would be really valuable.
Sorry, just one quick supplemental, Chair, before I finish. I just noticed when I was over there that President Duque is on record as supporting Nicasio Martinez to be the new head of the army. And this is a man with, accused of serious human rights abuses. I just wondered, I mean, again, it's a very disturbing message to be sending. Just wondered if you had any views on that.
Yeah, there have been concerns. There was a New York Times report in May that highlighted that there was a return to the... like combat, kind of a pressure on soldiers to report wins in combat. And that, obviously, in the past, those incentives under the Uribe administration had led to the extrajudicial scandal where thousands of civilians were murdered by soldiers and presented as if they were guerrillas killed in combat and received promotions and bonuses in reward. So there was a big kind of scandal around this piece. I understand the Minister of Defence took back some of those orders and reformed some of them, but there's still some there that are concerning. And this particular general had been implicated in some of those crimes, so there was a lot of concern that he was being promoted, and actually the opposition parties tried to block that in the Congress. It is very concerning, and the whole kind of doctrine within the military of the internal enemy and the enemy of the state is something that was discussed a lot, you know, during the peace talks about having to change the culture and the army becoming a protector of the people.
That was a portion of a debate before the Joint Committee on Foreign Affairs and Trade and Defence of the Irish Parliament, the Oireachtas. You heard Senator Paul Gavin. He's a Labour Party member of the Irish Senate. And Mariella Cohen, she's a senior international officer with the Trades Union Congress. They were discussing the Colombian peace process. And well, that's it for this week. I want to thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. Drug Truth Network programs are available by podcast. The URLs to subscribe are on the network homepage at drugtruth.net. The Drug Truth Network has a Facebook page. Please give it a like. Drug War Facts is on Facebook, too. Give it a like and share it with friends. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh, and of course also at Drug Policy Facts. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For now, for the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.